You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Is there hope for a new life after you're addicted to drugs, selling drugs? Detroiter Sheldon Hill is proof the answer is yes. After years and years of selling and using drugs, multiple arrests, Sheldon Hill went into an addiction recovery program. He was in his 40s, and it worked. Today, his sole mission in life is keeping others from making the mistakes and choices that he made as a young man. Sheldon Hill is a certified peer support specialist and prevention specialist. He works with a number of recovery groups around Southeast Michigan, particularly with the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority. And he set up his own community service organization to spread his recovery message even further. Sheldon Hill, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. You have said that growing up, you kind of had two sides. One was Sheldon, a respectful, responsible boy that your mother raised, and the other was Dennis, which is your middle name. So tell us about Dennis. What was Dennis like?
Dennis the Menace.
Remember
in the 60s, the television show, Dennis the Menace, and because my name, middle name is Dennis, I was allowed to get away with a lot, and it created an entitlement issue.
Meaning?
Meaning that I felt I was above the law. Rules didn't apply to me.
And
it didn't. My mom, my grandmother, just leave that boy alone. That's Dennis the Menace. Just leave him alone.
Okay, so Dennis the Menace didn't get those guardrails along the road.
No boundaries. Did not learn boundaries early at all.
Okay. How did that lead to you using drugs?
My dad was a drug dealer. My dad, at the age of 12 years old, came back into my life. I was having so many issues in school with truancy, fighting, and things of that nature, that when they brought my dad back into my life thinking he would help break this down, he took me with him to a restaurant, and he asked me to go to the store next door to buy a pop. I didn't have any money. So he said, well, that's not going to happen again. Gave me a $100 bill, and he said, later, I'll tell you what we can do about this. He takes me back to his home, hands me a pound of weed, and a pistol, and said, this is how you get your money. Showed me how to break it down, and I began dealing drugs for my dad at the age of 12 years old.
So you were dealing before you were using?
At the age of 12, yeah. I knew.
When'd you start using?
During the process of dealing, because, we would try the product and make sure it was good, and we were drinking, and it just went on from that point. I left high school with $300,000 cash. 150 pounds of weed still left to sell, and I'm dating my French teacher. So I've always, been...
You lived old. You
fast.
Lived old, and you lived hard and fast.
Fast. In 3 years, from the age of 14 and 17, I carried 14 caskets. Family members and friends who had either died from drug overdose, who had committed suicide, or were murdered in the process. The first person I seen murdered, my dad blew him out of a window because he stole some tools from us. So the issues that were traumatizing, I never identified them as trauma.
And it never dawned on you that you were an addict?
No. The lifestyle, my first book's entitled Dealers Are Addicts Too, Street Life, the Addiction.
And the toll it took on you personally, how many times were you shot?
I've been shot 9 times, 3 times, first time, 6 times, the second time. But I had become desensitized. Mm-hmm.
That's and arrests didn't stop you either.
No, this is what we're talking about. 77 bookings was as an adult. My first arrest, I was 12 years old. A police officer stopped me, and I started walking away, and he turned me back around and tore my shirt. I spent good money for that shirt, so I slapped him. I had no respect for the law. We were just above the law. My dad had friends, and they all looked at me as little Arnold, little man. My mom, with my dad being gone, and I'm providing for the household. Miss Hill, here comes your husband. They're calling me, and I'm Big D, and I had all of these different titles. And so the issue of entitlement was not, it was to be expected.
Did you ever have a point where, when this was all going on, where you were like, I need to get off this merry-go-round? Or did it just feel like, well, this is how people live?
It was how my dad lived, and my dad was my role model. I wanted him to be in my life, so I did what he did. But also, I built bridges for the state of Michigan and Army Corps of Engineers.
You had a job.
I kept jobs.
Yeah.
I never not worked, but I always had a hustle, and that was what we were taught. You always keep a hustle. So as area manager for Church of Fried Chicken, I'm running 5 restaurants, but I'm selling cocaine out the drive-through window.
Ultimately, what kinds of drugs did you wind up using?
Everything we sold. I mean, we went from TAC, mescaline. We smoked a lot of weed, hashish, angel dust, powder cocaine, and then went to crack cocaine, and crack cocaine eliminated everything else. Crack cocaine is a very selfish, greedy drug. It wants you to have no other. It's possessive.
What changed for you?
A so-called friend was actively using cocaine, freebasing, and he didn't want to stop. Well, I find out later from some of the young ladies he was with that because he didn't want to stop and he knew I had cocaine to sell, he called for me to come join them. I get there. He throws a rock into the pipe. The smoke swirls around in his glass bowl, and I'm mesmerized. It's like the genie in a bottle. I'm like, whoa. And then he hands it to me, and he puts one in for me. It was 2 days later. $24,000 worth of cocaine that I had powder had been cooked up and smoked. I hadn't been to work in 2 days, and I'm the executive senior store manager for the restaurant. And dawned on me, like, what just happened? Now I'm addicted. I can't stop. I have a dealer's habit where, I mean, it's costing me $12,000 a week in just cocaine.
So I want to know how it is you're here, healthy, sober, not using. What was the turning point and what made the difference to get you off this merry-go-round of drugs?
In the first place, I was doing it wrong. I don't like to smoke, so I wasn't inhaling it in my lungs. I was swallowing it into my stomach. So when I went for mental health services, and that's another thing that has to be addressed, my mental health needs. So it was necessary for me to accept the diagnosis, take medication to stabilize, then focus on regaining a healthy foundation, starting a new life. But because I had been swallowing the smoke instead of inhaling it in my lungs, it didn't take the same effects on me, health-wise or whatnot. I'm 58 years old. I'll be 59 this year. I've been shot 9 times, stabbed twice, jaw broke twice, hammer, pistol, boot, brick here, brick there, 3 bullets still in me. It's amazing.
What treatment stopped this for you and got you clean?
It wasn't treatment. It was a judge. Mm-hmm. I went in front of the judge for the very last time 14 years ago, and he asked a question. He said, Mr. Hill. I said, yes, Your Honor. He said, do you know you've been booked 77 times? And I don't know if I can say this on the radio, but there was a lady in the background. She said, damn, just like that. And I was like, oh, I was embarrassed.
That voice hit you. That voice got you. that her gut reaction.
I was embarrassed. I wasn't angry. I was embarrassed. And I said, no, Your Honor. He said, but I'm going to do this favor you asking me. And I did not know what he was talking about. But they have what they call a pre-sentence evaluation. Mm-hmm. And so I asked for drug treatment again for the 10th time. He said, I'm going to do that favor you asking me. I'm going to give you drug treatment. He said, but I promise you this much. If you ever come back in front of my courtroom again, you will go to the penitentiary. Now, mind you, I'm facing 4 charges. Conspiracy to interstate transport narcotics over 9 state lines, interstate transportation of stolen property over 9 state lines.
That's some serious
credit
time.
Card fraud and criminal racketeering. Yeah. 175 months federal time, 7.5 to 15 state time. He said 6 months in the county jail. Whew. And when he hit the gavel, I took off. The guard pulled his gun. He didn't. I was like, where are you going? I stepped away, reaching for the door handle to go back to the bullpen. He said, what are you doing? I said, it's over, Your Honor. You will never see me again. I'm talking to the judge. I promise you, you will never see me again. And they took me into the back. And within 30 days, I was in a rehab program in the jail, and I ended up starting a program in the jail called the Missing Dads Program. I went immediately to work, and I started to mentor. I'm constantly reaching out to young men as I built my network of dealers behind me. I figure if they follow me in, maybe they'll follow me out. And I began to share, and because I realized that 19 young men in that system, dads were missing in their lives, and that, or if they were with their dads, they used with their dads, that that was the problem. We had to go home. We had to begin to take care of our families.
So everything clicked in at last 14 years ago, and now you work to keep others. This is your mission. What do you say to young people who are a lot like you were when you were, you know, running around at 14 doing things that people never do in a lifetime? What do you tell them? What lessons did you learn through your years of addiction and now recovery?
You can't win. First of all, you can't win. The costs are astronomical. And the system is not designed for you to be successful this way. But you can be successful. Like for myself, as Church's Fried Chicken, I was a training store manager. Mm-hmm. So I trained now on entrepreneurship. It's a piece called Inner City Executives. So I help them write business plans and design a life that they can be successful without dealing and selling drugs. So, like, I'm the hope man, not the dope man now. Mm. I sell hope, not dope.
I want to talk about ways that family members can keep the kids away from the drug culture at the first place. Well, I mean, what do you tell parents and family members? What can they or should they be doing?
Looking out for the family member that is there causing the problem. My father was my problem. There are other family members that we have access to that aren't healthy, and we have to be kept away from them. They should be protecting us, but they're not. They're actually hurting us, and it's not fair.
Sheldon, what do you tell kids? What do you tell those teens who think that, oh, you're an old guy, you don't know anything? They know it all when they're teens, don't they?
They think they do.
They think they do. That's right. How do you crack that?
Transparency. I'm very honest with them about my suffering. They see me and they tell their friends, that's Mr. Hill. He came to our school and he used to smoke crack. And he told us about that. Who does not know someone that has some sort of addiction and has a shame of it? The stigma, the shame in it, and it's supposed to be kept secret, can no longer be kept secret. It should not be kept a secret. If it's an addiction in the family, if someone's suffering, don't say they're just sick. Tell them what's going on. They already know.
You ever struggle to stay drug-free? I mean, do you ever feel like, okay, I've got this. I don't have to work at my recovery anymore. I'm good. Or is there that voice still calling you back at times?
Oh, I still make meetings on a regular basis. I'm activities chairperson for Narcotics Anonymous. I handle all of these sober events for the West area of Detroit. It's a must. I mean, there's never not a liquor store with a light flashing when it gets dark. They just found out there were 285 unlicensed marijuana distribution centers in this city of Detroit, and they've shut down and still have 55 to go. It's big money. Drug sales are big business for somebody. It's never going away. So what I do is stay in touch. I mean, my daughters, my mom, friends in the fellowship, I stay in touch. So we have a whole culture of individuals that make meetings 30 years down the road, still making meetings.
And keeping an eye on each other.
We have to keep an eye on each other. We have to have it. It's not going anywhere.
Sheldon Hill is a state-certified peer support specialist and prevention specialist working for many recovery organizations, including the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority, and runs his own community service organization. Sheldon, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
I'm glad to be here.